From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, what is life?
One of the things we found we cannot define it at alone is the genetic level. And even when it gets booted up in a cell, the cell and that DNA is very much dependent on its environment.
That's Craig Venter, the renowned biologist who's trying to create life in a test tube. Today we'll explore some of the fundamental mysteries of life, from how it first started on Earth to the possibility of supremely intelligent life on other planets. Also, a conversation with the maverick scientist who gave us Gaia, James Lovelock, and an argument for why technology is evolving like life itself.
Technology is producing things that the organic tissues themselves could not produce. It's sort of a way of making things that wet DNA tissue alone could not make.
But before we go any further, we figured any talk about the question, what is life, has to start with this man.
Are our bodies and the bodies of the animals machines? This question, are we automatons, has about as often been answered emphatically in the positive as in the negative.
That is a rare recording of the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Erwin Schrödinger. In 1944, he wrote a slim book called What is Life?, which had a profound impact on later generations of chemists and biologists. We asked a few prominent scientists to comment on Schrödinger's influence. Here's Ken Miller, a cell biologist at Brown University, and co-author of the most widely used biology textbook in American high schools.
The book What is Life? Was based on a series of lectures that Schrödinger gave in England in the early 1940s, I think 1941 and 1942. Those lectures were so memorable that they were transcribed and bound into a book. And that book was widely read by physical chemists and biochemists in the late 1940s and early 50s. And in fact, James Watson, the co-discoverer of the double helical structure of DNA, said that it was indeed Schrödinger's book, What is Life?, that convinced him that there ought to be a physical and chemical answer to the notion of what is a gene. And the result, of course, was the double helical structure of DNA.
The appeal of the book was, did life come about spontaneously through molecular interactions, or was there some form of divine intervention that made the whole thing possible?
That's Nobel Prize-winning biologist James Watson, who, along with Francis Crick, discovered the basic structure of DNA.
I wanted to believe that there was nothing but molecules. That's all we had evidence for. You know, Schrödinger posed the question, what sort of molecule and how could you copy it?
Harold Varmus is another prominent scientist who studied Schrödinger's book, What is Life? He went on to win a Nobel Prize for his work on retroviruses and later led the National Institutes of Health. Today, Varmus is director of the National Cancer Institute.
Of course, the importance of Schrödinger's book was that he said, look, we mystify life. We talk about it in a philosophical way as though there's some kind of spiritual animus. But the fact is that living systems can be reduced to chemistry and physics.
Ken Miller says Schrödinger's willingness to ask very big questions is what made his book so revolutionary.
Schrödinger was a physicist. And in that book, What is Life?, he tried to speculate, partway between philosophy and partway between physics and chemistry, on the chemical nature of the gene. And he said, in fact, that the gene, the unit of inheritance passed from one generation to another, was very, very stable. Whereas most things, most atoms, most assemblies in the physical universe are not stable. And in fact, if you pick up a biochemistry textbook, a college-level book from the 30s or early 40s, you'll discover that there's a lot of skepticism about the notion that the gene actually could be a molecule. Well, Schrödinger argued it had to be a molecule. Watson and Crick took that up. So I think Schrödinger did have important things to say. And in particular, he laid the groundwork for our modern understanding of life as a physical and chemical phenomenon.
It's now been nearly 70 years since Erwin Schrödinger's book first appeared, and scientists have a pretty good grasp of the basic chemistry and biology of life.
But there is another level of thinking about human life in particular that generates a lot of controversy.
Again, Harold Varmus, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist.
So where do certain of our properties like generosity, altruism come from? What is consciousness? How can the brain actually do the things it does based solely on the properties of simple chemicals?
James Watson agrees. He says the most profound questions about life may be even harder to answer.
Now the big question in front of everyone is, how does the human brain operate? How can we store such a colossal amount of information and retrieve it sometimes so quickly? You know, how can you return a tennis ball coming at 130 miles an hour? You know, when we hit the ball, we're not, as before, we're conscious of hitting the ball. So the brain is, I think, when you get close to it, even more remarkable. You know, there's no computer that can do now what the human brain can.
That's James Watson, the legendary co-discoverer of the double helix structure of DNA. We also heard from Harold Varmus and Ken Miller.
Inside the cell is a tiny double helix. Another fancy word for DNA, which could also be a spiral staircase, which could also be a twisted ladder, which could also be a spring.
You ever stop to think about just how amazing life is? Craig Venter has. He's another renowned scientist who once pored over Schrödinger's book, What is Life? Venter says we're still learning about the miraculous nature of life on Earth.
We now have discovered a large number of organisms on our planet that can take huge doses of ionizing radiation. It can be totally desiccated, exist in a vacuum, but once it finds water, that organism can rehydrate and repair all the damage that's done and start replicating again. We have organisms that exist in such strong acid or base, if I put my finger in it, my finger would dissolve instantly. But we have bacteria that live in those conditions. I think the world record for temperature right now thus far on our planet is a bacteria that lives in archaea at on the order of 120 degrees centigrade. Water boils at 100 degrees centigrade.
Craig Venter's widely regarded as one of science's leading innovators, and he's not afraid to butt heads with the scientific establishment. In fact, he competed with the federal government's own Human Genome Project to be the first to map our genome. Venter's also at the forefront of efforts to create life from scratch. In May of 2010, he became the first scientist to create a synthetic life form. While his research team didn't actually create life in a test tube, they came as close as anyone has so far. Steve Paulson wanted to know what drives Craig Venter.
You are typically described as a maverick scientist with a big ego and a confrontational style. Of course, you famously chose to compete with the huge government program to sequence the human genome. What would you say motivates you as a scientist?
Well, scientific discovery is certainly the number one thing that motivates me. I got turned on early to science and found no greater thrill in life than making new scientific discoveries, adding to the knowledge pool, understanding our own lives, understanding our universe around us, trying to recognize how finite life is, something I learned in Vietnam from seeing a large number of young men my age and younger killed there. I felt I came out of Vietnam with a unique gift that so many others didn't have. I had my life in front of me, and I've been determined to accomplish something with it.
Let me ask you about that experience in Vietnam. You were a Navy medic, which I am guessing must have been a harrowing experience. Did you see a lot of people die?
I think everybody in Vietnam that was in the medical corps, unfortunately, did. I was there during the Tet Offensive in Da Nang, and we were overwhelmed with casualties, with the wounded and the dead and the dying. I had to learn what triage really meant, of how to help those that you could and just make comfortable the ones that you clearly could not help. Those are tough lessons to learn at age 20 and 21, and it changed the direction of my life.
How did it change your life?
Well, I went from being a poor student in school that nearly flunked out of high school due to lack of interest. Somebody who moved to Southern California after barely graduating from high school to take up a surfing career. to coming back to wanting to see how much I could accomplish in my lifetime.
I'm wondering if that experience of seeing so much death also influenced your decision to go into medical research.
One of the lessons I absolutely learned in Vietnam was knowledge was power, and it was actually very frustrating how limited the medical profession was. All the diseases that I've ended up working on, I was first exposed to as a Navy corpsman, including malaria, tuberculosis, cholera, even syphilis and gonorrhea, all the organisms that my teams decoded the genomes of to help understanding of those diseases, help come up with new vaccines, new treatments.
I want to pick up on sort of this reputation about you, this idea that you are a maverick scientist who goes his own way. Do you see that as an important part of your identity? I mean, do you think about that, and do you sort of instinctively bristle at efforts to direct what you do?
No, I think it's more important as a scientist, but I think these lessons apply to all aspects of life. I recently told graduating classes that if they're not butting up against dogma, against bureaucracy, against the static state of thinking in our society, that they're not doing the right things. We can't keep doing what we're doing as a society and expect to survive long term on this planet. So to me, it's more of a shame there's not more radical thinking. That's certainly how science moves forward. It goes by people having new ideas that take the whole field in new directions. So it's unfortunate that it seemed as unusual.
So is that why you formed your own company, to compete with the federal effort to map the human genome? You felt like there was too much homogeneous thinking there?
Well, it was even worse than that. That homogeneous thinking, even though we had a whole new approach to sequence genomes that, in fact, allowed us to sequence the first three genomes in history, we couldn't get funding from the federal government because the peer review system decided that these techniques would, in fact, not work for sequencing the human genome. So I had the choice of doing nothing because I couldn't get funding. Fortunately, an instrument company that sold sequencing instruments had a new instrument, and they were excited about using it with my new technique, and they put up money to sequence the human genome. The only catch was they wanted to form a new company. That's what led to Celera. So I would have far preferred to have public funding, but that's not the nature of science funding in this country. We have tens of billions of dollars available for research, but it's a system that's largely unwilling to fund new ideas. Once new ideas get established, it's relatively easy to get substantial funding to follow up on them. And by the way, every lab that was sure these techniques would not work have adopted them all as the standard of how genomic science is now done in the field. So I think that sort of proved that the experiment was worth doing.
That's Craig Venter talking with Steve Paulson. Venter was one of the first scientists to sequence the human genome. In May of 2010, his research team created the first synthetic life form. So what is life? We asked a few people on the streets outside our studio.
I think life is the result of chemical processes, totally explicable by science.
Life is taking advantage of everyday opportunities and not selling yourself short.
When I think about life, I make a distinction between life and existence. I guess life has got like a sort of a biological sense to it. To make it simple, I think it's the mere fact of living.
I think life is, I guess, whatever you make of it. It's an opportunity and a challenge and scary.
What is life? Something that doesn't rot, not rotting.
I think of organic stuff. I think of bacteria, plants, people, lions, anything that is growing.
This weird unreality that we seem to be living, that seems to be like a shadow of what else is beyond, that I can't actually fathom right now.
Life is the sum total of our emotions, our creativity, our passion, our giftedness, all bundled together, walking the earth, seeking to make it better, sweeter, more beautiful, helping those that are disenfranchised and feel that they have no power, and living in harmony with others, bringing harmony and beauty to the planet.
A special thanks to Brittany DeAnda for producing that Vox Pop. Coming up, James Lovelock tells the story of his revolutionary Gaia theory.
If you expand the definition of life a bit, you can look on planets like the Earth as alive. They regulate their temperatures, they metabolize, they do all sorts of things that living things do. The only thing they don't do is reproduce.
Life is made out of cells. Cells make copies of themselves. And they make copies of themselves.
But to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What is Life? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Sha-la-la-la.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Noor Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.